I'm Brian.
I'm Griff. And this is the eBay for Business podcast, your source for the information and inspiration that can help you start, manage, and even grow your business on the world's most powerful marketplace. And this is episode 254. Wow, 254, it finally strikes me. That's a lot of talking.
Some of our maybe older listeners, more experienced listeners age-wise, would remember CARF 254. Wasn't that a television show back in the day?
Yeah, the two cops were Tootie and Muldoon. That I remember.
Maybe one or two of our listeners remembers the show.
Hey, you know, if you go to eBay, right? I wonder. Let's go to eBay. I'm typing this in as we talk, and I'm going to type in CAR 54. It wasn't 254. I think it was
CAR 54. Oh, was it just CAR 54?
Oh, yeah. Look, there's tons of stuff. There's CDs, DVDs. There's a TV guide.
So it was 54.
Yeah, it wasn't 254.
Which makes sense. You know, there weren't that many police back then.
I don't think that's true.
They only needed 54 cars, not 254.
Now with YouTube, you can find clips of just about anything. So if you don't know what we're talking about, but you're mildly intrigued and your interest has been kind of piqued, just search on YouTube for CAR 54.
Or don't.
Or don't. Or get back to listing something and making productive choices in your life rather than running down YouTube rabbit holes.
Or think about the television show when you were a kid, or maybe it wasn't even a TV show. Maybe it was a streaming show, and find an item that you know you could resell for that around that item, because someone might want to collect something.
I don't think there's any boomers who remember streaming shows from their childhood.
Well, we don't have just boomers listening.
And let's hope not.
We better not.
Back in the day, we only had three options. We had ABC, NBC, CBS, and some hokey local UHF, actually.
We also had AM radio.
Yeah, we had 8-tracks. We used to have these vinyl records that you put on a little spinning disc. They're now hip again. And we liked it.
My daughter has some records because they became hip again.
Yeah. And of course, where can you find old vinyl? Always keeping it relevant.
On eBay.
There you go. Hey, do you know what record day is?
I don't.
Oh, you're going to love this. Except Rob's really into this. So record stores across the country have something called record day. It's usually on a Saturday. And it's where all these special released vinyls come out. And people line up, they call in, or they get online and get a spot at their local record store. And each store gets an allotment from the record companies. And they get in line and they buy these things up as collector's items. And then the only other place you can get them after they're sold out is where?
eBay.
Thank you.
Wow.
Although, except Rob doesn't put any up on eBay. He's just storing them somewhere. There's a vault somewhere in that room of his where he's got like tons of vinyl.
So you're creating your own vault.
I can't complain. I have this huge, huge closet outside of my bedroom, and you can't put anything in there because there is container after container of fragrances.
Ah, I was going to say, it's still containers of stuff that needs to get unpacked, but no, it's your inventory.
Yeah, it's inventory, and I have to start listing it. I have been listing a little bit, but I got to ramp it up, and I straightened out a section of our garage here where I can, you know, I have my light cube set up, and I have some shelves for storage, and the boxes are underneath a work table, and it's getting there. I don't feel a big sense of urgency for some reason, so I know this is going to sound really trivial, but I've gone from 0 to 30 listings, no, 32 today.
That's good.
I don't have as much as your daughter, which is embarrassing.
But my daughter has like cranked it up over the last month.
Good for her.
I'm excited.
Well, we are too.
Because like she can do it for the rest of her life. She's only 22. Someday she'll be a school teacher. So it's a perfect thing to like create supplemental income during the summer. Well, Griff.
Yeah, what, Brian?
Who is our guest this week?
I thought you'd never ask. Our guest this week has been sitting in the green room for the last month. It's eBay Seller Experience Chief of Staff, your friend and mine, Valerie Yee.
Valerie's a great guest. Super knowledgeable.
Valerie's here to pull back the curtain on how eBay releases new code to the site, you know, new features and new enhancements. And she's also going to talk a little bit about what eBay does when a bit of that code goes awry, or sometimes when things don't work and how sellers can make them work. There's a whole lot of content there, so you're going to want to listen to that.
Would code goes awry be kind of equivalent to like a glitch?
Well, you could think that. The dreaded G word.
Yes. Yeah.
Every website has this problem. We're not immune to it. We've got a lot of code that gets updated and released. And I have to say, given what I know about what goes on in that part of the eBay universe. It's amazing how everything goes right most of the time. But sometimes things go a little wrong, and it's interesting to know what eBay does to make sure that it doesn't impact the business of sellers. But before that, I suspect there's no pressing news this week, right, Brian?
No news this week, except for the upcoming eBay Open.
Ooh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
So that will be at the end of September. It kicks off on September 26th. If you have not registered for one of the four in-person kickoff parties, Phoenix, Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia, I believe there is still room at those events.
Oh, really?
I believe so. I checked yesterday. I did not check today. Sign up. And if you can't make one of those, definitely register for the event. And then I'll also encourage you to check ebay.com/seller meetings, because sellers who are not close to those locations are hosting in-person events like in Akron, Ohio, and Colorado Springs, and other places like that.
Florida. Yeah.
So check out those if you want to connect with other sellers as a kickoff on the Tuesday before the 3-day seller eBay Open.
There you go. I'm surprised there's still spaces at the four events. Those usually sell out within a couple of weeks. Well, of course, they've only been open since the beginning of this week, right? So by the time you hear this.
Oh, that's true.
They could be sold out.
I always forget that.
You snooze, you lose.
Yes. Well, check it out just to make sure. Going in person's a lot of fun.
It's something to look forward to, and we're going to talk a lot about it. In fact, we have a segment coming up, I believe, in about a month where we talk a lot about eBay Open and what's going on. You'll hear us mentioning that a lot in the next 5 episodes or so, so stay tuned. But like Brian said, if you're in those four areas, go check out if there's any space left.
And if not, check out seller-hosted kickoff parties as well.
Now, let's meet the Seller Experience Chief of Staff, Valerie Yee. Every website, no matter where it is, how big, how small, runs into the occasional code bug. It just happens. It's inevitable. Remember that most websites are dynamic. They don't get to shut the website down for 6 months while they build new code base. But it's not the inevitable bug that matters. It's how the website manages to deal with them and how quickly they deal with them. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And joining us to help us get some insight into this topic is Chief of Staff of Seller Experience here at eBay, Valerie Yee. Welcome back, Valerie.
Hi, Griff. Thanks for having me back again.
So, Valerie, remind us, what's your background here at eBay?
I have been at eBay almost 19 years, which is crazy to think about. I have watched the product evolve from when we didn't have a native app. We were on just a few countries. And we were on just a few countries. It was just much smaller. It was fascinating. We had one huge code base. And when we completed code, it took us 6 weeks from code complete to live to site back then. And now we launch code like 3 days a week.
I didn't know it was 6 weeks back then.
It was, yeah. It was kind of crazy.
It used to be every 6 weeks. It's now 3 times a week. How does that work? How do we roll it out?
So we act as independent scrum teams. We practice the agile methodology. And so each scrum team, usually it's anywhere from 6 to 12 to 14 engineers. And they work on a particular section of the code base. And they are the subject matter experts in that piece. And there are many, many, many scrum teams across the organization. And they all launch code on demand as they need to. So in certain areas in seller experience and the listing tool, for example, they launch code 3 days a week, but some teams may launch code daily. Just depends. Some have a weekly schedule. It's up to the code, actually. It's up to the team. They get to decide.
Who coordinates all this? Is it you?
No, heck no, no, no. So there are agile leads is what they call them. And so the agile leads ensure that the code is up to snuff. They do a ton of automated test cases. It's not done manually as much anymore. And just make sure that it all gets through all of the test cases to make sure everything that all the standard stuff works as expected.
Sometimes sellers will tell us they're seeing different things. Like one group of sellers will say, I'm seeing this. Well, I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing this. Why does that happen?
There's a couple of different reasons. One is that we do a lot of testing, A/B testing. We do a lot of ramping, especially in the search area, is that they will be constantly running tests to see which algorithm works best to get you the most buyers for your products. That's why sometimes you'll see something different than I see something. And because I work here, I actually get access to secret beta stuff in advance too. So my stuff's even more different than what you see. But it's a little tricky sometimes when, we're out there reading what customers are saying. It's hard to reproduce because we don't know what test that person may be in.
Yeah, I find the same thing, not just for myself, but when I'm taking calls or questions from sellers. And as you mentioned, going from 6 weeks to three or more times a week, so much change. And you've been here for 19 years. I've been here for going on, well, technically 27 years. And yeah, things have changed a lot. And we forget how different it was. One of the things that has changed is that eBay has become much bigger and much more robust and complex as a global platform for sellers in countries and different situations around the world. But also back 19 years ago, when you started, there was hardly any competition.
That's true.
If you were looking for marketplace platforms where you could buy and sell, you know, you could count them on less than one, if the fingers on one hand. And now that's not the case. And doesn't this fact about competition help drive the fact that we got to keep the site up to the competition, and it means changes to our code base?
I would say it's actually two factors. One is definitely competition, and the second one is technology changes. There is always new stuff happening. Like whenever you update your iOS, like my favorite feature from a couple iOS updates ago is that you can copy text from an image. Like when you take a picture of something, you can actually now take the text and copy that text. That's new. That's new technology that didn't exist two updates ago, right? So the fact is that there's new things we can take advantage of to make the product better. And that's also why we have data rate fast as well.
We had a recent code issue for Memorial Day. It's known internally, I guess, as the Memorial Day code bug.
It happened. That was just the weekend it happened. Unfortunately, on a holiday weekend.
Can you take us through the timeline of how it was discovered and then the solution?
Yeah, sure. So it's just a little use case we wanted to share with you just to see a life in the day of an engineer and how things happen in the back end. And so we have a team that is part of the customer support organization, and they monitor the intake of issues that are reported by you, our customers, as you call in or as you chat, and they send issues to the appropriate engineering team to investigate. We have escalation paths that we have to keep up to date to make sure the names are always accurate. And so and people get phone calls in the middle of the night sometimes and are on holiday weekends. And so that's the main avenue. In addition, many of our employees, including myself, are members of many public seller Facebook groups. We also read the eBay community forums and we watch for trends. I read them on the weekends when I'm on Facebook, and I will definitely send things to my team when I see things, but I look for trends. So,
and we have internally, I think a lot of our sellers may know what Slack is. And Slack is our internal platform for communicating with other employees, both as teams and individuals. And there is a Slack channel for employees who notice things that may need looking at. I now tend to check that every day in the morning just to see. Yeah. And it's mostly so that I'm more aware if a question comes in, I may be able to answer it better based on the information I get there.
We also use the product, right? I sell on eBay myself. I've sold over 1,200 things, and I use the product because I want to see what our sellers are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. And there's a prod bugs channel in our Slack world, and there's definitely a lot of people reporting things in there. And it's like, hey, is this expected behavior? And the teams will jump on it and go look at it. It's kind of fun.
In the parlance, I believe it's called eating the dog food.
Yes.
Right? So how is this bug solved?
So for the specific advanced listing tool bug, there was an issue where for some of our users, it was appearing blank on their browser. And it was a very small subset of sellers. And it was on Memorial Day weekend, of course. The team was notified via customer support monitoring, and they worked the holiday weekend. They reproduced the issue and immediately rolled back the changes that were made on the Friday. And it's standard procedure to roll back the previous version you had to ensure the minimal customer impact. And I just want to call out, like I said earlier, is that, you know, before any code is released to the public, we do run automated test cases to ensure that the standard use cases are successful. But sometimes edge cases do exist, right? It is a very complex ecosystem. We're constantly changing. I said there's multiple Scrum teams and they're working their own way. And so it's like sometimes maybe they change something that didn't make in our test case. That happens too. We try our best to make sure everything's running kosher as possible.
Beyond taking the reports and rolling back, is there anything the team does kind of proactively to see if they can figure out what's going on?
So yeah, in this particular case, actually, what they did is then to find the root cause of the issue, because we knew something was going on, the team added some additional troubleshooting tracking to the code. We don't do this for everything because the code would be super bloated and super slow. So there is tracking in the code by default to just track the basic things to make sure things are working appropriately. But they add additional stuff just because it's, you know, they want to go dig into what happened. So for this specific case, they made 4 code changes on that Friday and that were made to listing tool. So to find the culprit, the team relaunches one code at a time. They go, okay, they closely monitor it with the additional tracking data to try to pinpoint that issue. And so, of course, it was the fourth one that had the issue. I watched them do it on Monday, or sorry, not Monday's a holiday. So they did it on Tuesday and they did it on Wednesday. And then Thursday night, I was in the office super late. It was like 10 o'clock at night. A bunch of us here still working on it. And I'm in San Jose. And it was actually kind of fun not fun for them, but I'm sitting there witnessing this whole process of watching them literally roll the code on one, you know, they're monitoring it on one monitor. And then the second monitor is watching the like error codes. And so they're watching the error codes increase. I mean, it went from like, you know, 99.9% to like 99.6%. And I'm like, look, it's going down. They're like, it's okay. It's still 99.6. So, and then what happens is then they can sit there and they can now know which accounts are achieving the hitting the bug. They will then go look at that and figure out like what code is calling. And because of this, eBay has a minimum standard as which web browsers we support. So in order to protect us, and I mean you as the customer and eBay as a company, the latest versions of browsers are always safer from a security standpoint and also from a functionality standpoint. Like I mentioned, there's always new features being added to things. In this particular case, the code change, and okay, I'm going to get a little technical for a minute. Hope you don't, I'll lose people. But in this particular case, the fourth culprit was a code change that was refactoring a portion of that code to utilize the latest technology for the web browser. And what this meant in reality was that the older browsers didn't understand what that new code command we were using was, because that code command literally didn't exist when the browser version was created. And so it got to that code command and went, I don't know what this is. And it went blank. Doop. Now, in reality, we should fail better. Like we should have a little banner at the top. If you've ever noticed, I personally have like the original version of the iPad and I can no longer update my iOS. Apple has said, no, we no longer support this. So sorry. So I know for a fact there's apps I just cannot use on my iPad. I need to get a new one, but you know, it's convenient to just sit there and play my solitaire or whatever it is. Surf the web, it still works for that, but doesn't have all the latest and greatest bells and whistles anymore. But it's an interesting thing is that we do it on some things, but maybe in this case, it just wasn't that big of a change that we felt it was a browser failure of like in terms of this browser is no longer supported. The reality is that a small subset of customers were using an outdated browser and that they were the ones that were affected, which goes back to your original thing of like, how come sometimes people have issues and sometimes people don't? Partially it's because of the testing we do. But the other thing too is if 95% of the people are using the latest and greatest browser, it works fine for them. And that's that 5%, and I'm making up the numbers in this particular case, by the way. It's that, you know, small percentage that didn't update that are having the issue. And so it's really frustrating for them, obviously. And it's frustrating because everyone else is going, I don't have this problem, so I don't know how to help you. So that's the inside sort of scoop of what happened on the Memorial Day when the advanced listing tool went blank for a few users.
Well, thanks for the insight. I didn't know any of this either. I should have been paying more attention. You know, the thing that you remind me of is the different levels of urgency that a system like iOS or even Android will do when there's a need for an update, whether it's security update or technology update, as opposed to the browsers. So Android or iOS on your iPhone, and I know Windows and the Mac OS, they have big alerts saying it's time to upgrade to the latest one. And they don't let you just click away. They're going to remind you and remind you.
And they snooze, right? It'll say snooze till tomorrow. And that's all you get. You're like, okay, I guess tomorrow I'm going to be reminded again.
Right. And I know at eBay, if you work at eBay and there's a system update, you don't have a choice. You get a warning screen that says in 1 hour, your system's going to shut down because we're updating it. And we don't care what you think. It's basically
even subtext. If you're about to report a podcast, it does not matter. Yes, exactly.
That's happened.
I've had to
actually take that into account. But when I look at my Chrome browser, and I happen to just look at it now, the only thing that's there in the little corner is a little oval that says update.
Upper right-hand corner, exactly.
And the only urgency is it's in pink and red.
Does. It actually goes from green to yellow to orange to red. So if you're using Chrome, which is what I use, yeah, upper right-hand corner. If you look for that, it'll say update, and it gets redder and redder.
The call to action here is besides just updating your OS, whatever it may be, whether it's on your mobile phone or your desktop, keep your browsers updated, or you may find yourself in this little situation that some people did over Memorial Day.
And then also know that we code to certain standards to the latest browsers. That's where it's supposed to work the best. It's funny, I was talking to sellers this week, and I was asking for like an example of like a non-techie example of what this new tech that's created or something doesn't work, non-compatible things. And the example that we kind of came up with was my car is old. It's very old and it doesn't have AirPlay or whatever. And so like if you buy a new car now, there's no CD player. It's only AirPlay. Like that happens. Like there's things that just go away over time. And you're like, okay, you don't need a CD player anymore because no one has CDs anymore. Well, in theory, they expect you to connect your phone to the car and all your music is on your phone now. Things change. You have to evolve.
And that may be the state of change at the moment, but if you've lived long enough to see trends come and go, like I never thought I'd see vinyl return, I'm not going to say we will never see CDs or even cassettes come back into cars because who knows?
But probably not 8-tracks. Probably not 8-tracks. Oh, those probably not coming back.
Who knows? Well, 8-tracks were problematic. So we romanticized them, but those things broke all the time. Plus, they had that annoying, when they go between tracks, the music would stop because they could never time it with the tape at a break of a song. So you'd be in the middle of the song and it would stop while it moved to the next track. So maybe not 8-tracks.
I used to sell blank cassette tapes, actually. My husband had like a bunch and they were hot sellers on eBay, actually. New cassette tapes to sell well.
More so than I think any other website. Our sellers are really invested in helping to keep our site up as well. So when they see something that doesn't look right, they like to let us know. How can sellers report possible issues or bugs that they may notice?
There's a couple different ways. Obviously, if you're talking to customer support, you can tell them about it. I would actually suggest first, there is a known issue site just to go check if it's a known issue. We already know about it. We're working on it. It's on ebay.com/STS. And Griff's going to put all these in the notes as well. So if you miss out the links, he can put that in the show notes. And so that's if you want to see like, hey, I'm experiencing this. Like, does eBay know about this already? Because we might. Most likely we do. So you can check there first. And if it's not there, then on the eBay community boards, you can submit a technical issue. I think you just search for report technical issues, Griff. Is that where you go?
Yeah. If you go to community.ebay.com and then you can search the menus in the top for technical issues. You can also search Google for community technical issues and it shows up. As you mentioned, we'll put all these links as we do every week into the summary overview for the episode.
And I would say another way, but less likely on this one, but if you are using any of our feedback systems where it says, tell us what you think. I wouldn't really necessarily put a bug in there, but if it's something that's not urgent, like it's a sort of a nitpick thing that you'd like us to change in the product, you can also use the tell us what you think, and that will make it to the product team responsible for the page you're looking at, actually. So depending on where you are, it actually changes who receives that information. So it is contextual. I would also say, please try to be as detailed as possible. Like if you have a specific use case, item ID, some reproduced steps, because I will tell you, nothing is more disheartening on my side when we get a report of an issue and we can't reproduce it.
Because you don't have the information.
We don't have the information. So I would say the more you can tell us the exact steps you did to reproduce it, it's much more likely we can get it to the right hands of the right engineer to really take a look at and find that needle in the haystack.
We also have a page where you can go in Security Center, and that link is at the bottom of any eBay page, where once you've clicked it, look for the links for Protect Your Information. And there is a section there that will give a link to each one of the more popular browsers and the most up-to-date version. But you can also do that directly in your browser by going to, it's usually in the upper right-hand corner, like in Chrome, clicking on the hamburger, the little three ellipses that are on their side, and then look for any update information. And then, like for Chrome, it's right there. It says it in red right now. Update. And just make sure you're always using the most updated version of your browser.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that page actually doesn't have the browser versions we support. And the reality is they update so fast that it'd be hard to keep that up to date. So the messaging says, just make sure you have the latest version. That is sort of the punchline of this whole podcast here. It's a huge process to launch all this code. It's a very complex marketplace. And I know Griff keeps saying the site, but we also support the native mobile apps as well. And on the iOS and the Android side. So that is two more code bases that we have to work on. It's very complex. We are crossing 190, I think, countries across the world that our buyers live in. It's definitely a lot of work. Our engineers work very hard and they want to make sure that the product is as high quality as possible for you guys to be successful.
Well, that's always good news. Valerie, thank you so much for taking time out of you just got back from Salt Lake. I know you were visiting sellers.
Yes, my flight landed about, I don't know, 3 hours ago.
Thank you for coming into the studio to talk with us. I hope we'll see you at eBay Open.
You will. I am going to be in person at the launch event in Philadelphia. Shaudi will be there as well. She will be the leader that is kicking off that one. And so I'll be there. So hopefully I can see some people in Philadelphia.
If you've got questions or comments you'd like to present directly to an eBay employee like Valerie or Shaudi, and you're in the Philadelphia area, make sure that on, I believe it's July 30th, that the early sign-up, there's early sign-up that happens July 30 or 31st. I can't remember if the which
one of
date
those two
is.
Days, yes.
Yeah. So, and we talk about the actual date. I'm sorry. My memory has failed me again. Sign up early so that you can grab a space, because space is limited at the actual live events for eBay Open. So you want to be first in line or you'll miss out.
Yeah, it was really fun last year.
Yeah, it was. Yes. Valerie, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Griff. Thanks, everybody.
Valerie Yee is Chief of Staff of Seller Experience at eBay. She's been here for 19 years. We were talking about and learning about what goes on inside eBay when an issue arises.
You got questions?
Oh, brother, do we have questions? But you know, the good thing is we got answers. But Brian, this is an unusual week.
Ah.
We only have two questions.
Only two?
Only two, but one of them, it's rather involved, and it's actually kind of an account issue. And I know we have in the past have said we don't really get into specific account issues, but I think there's some learnings here that might be helpful. So we're going to do that one as well. Now, the first one that we're going to address is, it's actually a pretty easy one. It's from an eBay seller named Chris, and he sent the following to podcast@ebay.com. Like always, Brian, would you read this one?
I'd be happy to. Hello, I really enjoy the podcast and hope that you can answer my question. I got back into reselling late last year and just recently started to sell internationally once I learned about the new eBay International Shipping Program. I received a message from a buyer in France inquiring about why my shipping was so expensive for a $15 ball cap. I believe he was quoted around $24. I could only respond that I charged $4.99 for domestic shipping and had no control on what international shipping would be. This got me to thinking, how does eBay calculate international shipping? My listing contained no package dimensions or weights. I just charge a flat $4.99 because I can pretty much mail the hat in an 8x8x8 box at about 12 ounces anywhere in the lower 48 for that price. I have hundreds of other listings of various weights and sizes that are flat rate or free shipping, and the listings don't contain weights or dimensions. Does eBay have a magic way of knowing what postage will be for every item? I worry that eBay may quote an international buyer a much higher rate than necessary, which could cause me to lose sales. Thanks for all the information and entertainment you give me. Sincerely, Chris Behan.
Entertainment. Yay!
It is. Yes. Once in a while.
Chris, before we get started, I got to tell you, if you're not including the weights and dimensions, then eBay is making some estimations, and that's why they're seeing higher prices. The first step is you have to put in, for example, that 8x8x8 box for dimensions in 12 ounces, because it's important when eBay figures the rate that the buyer's going to pay. And you can view the rate card for eBay International Shipping on Seller Center. Just go to the Seller Center page, select shipping from the top menu bar, hover over the option for choosing a carrier or service, and then select the menu option below that for international shipping details. Yes, it's a long navigation, but it's easier than us spelling out the URL.
Yeah, and we'll also put that link in the summary overview for episode 254.
Right. eBay uses what's called a prediction model that helps us estimate the size of the package. We use either the actual weight of the item in our rate card, or we use the volumetric weight. Whichever is greater is what is quoted to the buyer. Now, the problem is you haven't provided the weight and the dimensions, so that we're going to automatically go to what might be a higher charge.
That's right. In addition to the shipping costs, we also charge a percentage of the transaction, which pays for insurance of the item.
Yeah.
Then depending on the price of the item and where it is going to the buyer, we may pay taxes and duties at the time of checkout. The taxes and duties are determined based on the individual country stipulations.
Yeah, and they're different for every country. So don't forget those. Those taxes and duties, which aren't apparent when you list the item, can actually boost that price up in some cases. So you're probably wondering how we calculate this thing called volumetric weight. Well, it's not that complicated. Actually, Chris, it's pretty straightforward. The calculation is the package width times height times length divided by 166. And we use the dimensions the seller supplies with the listing. See why that's important? You got to provide those dimensions. Once we have that figure, we then compare that to the weight the seller provided. The greater number is what will be assessed at checkout. So for example, let's say for a listing, the seller provides dimensions of 25 by 12 by 4 with a weight of 3 pounds. So that's our example.
Okay, so let's see, sussing it out on paper. The formula for volumetric weight for the example is the package width of 25 inches times the length of 12 inches.
Yeah.
Times the height of 4 inches, which equals, carry the one, that's a total of 1,200 inches.
Yeah.
So now I divide 1,200 by 166.
Yep.
And the number reaches 7.5.
Yes.
So the volumetric weight of the parcel is 7.5 pounds.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a lot for a baseball cap.
We didn't use the baseball cap as an option, but we could. We could say, what's 8 by 8 by 8?
Right.
Eight times 8 is 64. 8 times 64 is 512, right? And yeah. Then you divide that by 166. It's 3 pounds.
Okay.
Yeah. So kind of the same thing we're talking here, but that would be the weight. Now, you said,
I think he said 12 ounces.
12 ounces. Yeah. I think 8 by 8 by 8 is a big box to put a hat in. You could stick that hat, if it's just a cap, you could put that into a padded envelope and it's going to be fine. It's not going to break, right? It's made out of cloth. You could save the buyer a lot of money for shipping if you make the package as small as possible without sacrificing the item's safety in transit. But in this case, in the example we used with the 25 by 12 by 4, because the package is larger, we charge based on the volumetric weight, and the buyer will be charged in this case for a 7.5 pound package if compared to the rate card and not the weighted weight of the parcel, which is 3 pounds.
And didn't we provide a tip in a recent episode for a seller who was curious as to what the shipping shows for an international buyer?
Oh, Brian, you have such a good memory. We did do that. A seller can always go directly to an international eBay site, search for one of their items by item number, because item number is the easiest. You can just copy that number before you go to the international eBay site. And then once you're on the listing page, you find it. You change the country shown in the shipping section to the same country as the eBay international site you're visiting. This will show you exactly what a buyer in that country sees for shipping costs through eBay International Shipping.
So, Chris, the bottom line here is that the seller should always provide accurate package weight and dimensions, and whenever possible, provide the smallest shipping parcel as possible without sacrificing the safety of the item.
Yeah, that's really important. And I don't know why you'd put a cap in an 8x8 box, but that's just me.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was a fedora that might get crushed, yeah, it's something different.
Yeah, I think if he does that also, my assumption is the buyer's going to see a lower rate for the international stuff.
Oh, no, he will. I mean, they will. If you were to take that cap, if it's a cloth cap, just stick it into a padded envelope, it's going to be a lot less volumetric weight. Now on to the next question, which is the complicated one for this week. It was sent to podcast@ebay.com by seller Liz. It's also in two parts. This is her first email. I recently sold an item and the buyer opened a claim saying I sent the wrong item. He included pictures of the item he received and it's the item he is going to return. The problem is that I shipped the correct item as described in my listing and have never seen the item he photographed. I don't resell professionally. Every item I sell is an item I have personally purchased, so I know I never owned the item in the photos. I also personally photograph and package and ship every item in the store. The item I sold him is gone from my inventory, further proof to me that I sold and sent the correct item. The item was a great deal for him at $110 because it knew that item was $300, and I have no idea what he is sending back. I have all positive reviews, and I'm afraid to complain or appeal because I don't want to jeopardize my seller rating. By the time you respond, I'm sure I will have lost this battle. But it's very upsetting to be out the item, my money, and risking a ding against me when I'm 100% the victim of fraud in this case. There is a lot of disparate information out there about how to handle this type of situation, so I'm hoping to get direct and correct information from you two. Oh dear, the pressure's on.
I think we can handle it.
Well, let's see. I appreciate everything you do, and I'm a devoted follower of your podcast. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Liz.
Yeah, thank you. We responded to Liz with the following. Liz, so my advice, whenever this sort of thing, is as follows. Your first move is to assume that somebody made a mistake, either the buyer or you. Perhaps he purchased the mistaken item from another seller and is confusing you with that seller. That's happened to me. It does happen. I advise that you message the buyer with a link to the item he bought from you and ask him if he perhaps made a mistake about which seller sold him the item he is wanting to return. Don't be accusatory, just ask. Wait for a response. If he responds telling you, for example, that, oh, I guess I made a mistake, then ask him to close out the return request and consider opening one with the seller who sold him the item he disputes. No consequences to your account. However, if the seller claims that no mistake was made, don't argue with him. Tell him to send the item back, then wait to receive the item. Sometimes the buyer never actually sends the item back. If that's the case, wait out the clock. After 30 days or so, eBay will close the return window. No consequences to your account. But if the buyer does return the item and the item you receive is not the item you sent, you may elect to dispute the return and ask eBay to step in. In the process, be sure to provide all the necessary documentation requested. You have the photos the buyer sent, you have a message, and if they clearly show a different item, eBay may rule in your favor. However, we can't tell you with any certainty that they will, because
correct.
That's the whole thing about account issues on and having them on the podcast.
Yep.
But your other option, if you're above standard and the listing in question offered free shipping for returns, you may elect to wait for the item to arrive back. And if the item is not the item you sent, and you're above standard and offer free returns, or you're a top-rated seller, you can withhold up to 50% of the buyer's refund without consequence to you. The buyer cannot appeal. Note this option, by the way, is not available if you ask eBay to step in. So you have to think about this, right? So that's where we were. And then Liz emailed me back after a few days and said, "Hi, guys. Thank you on so many levels. I appreciate you. I was 100% wrong." So she stands corrected.
Yeah.
"I'm so ashamed and also so glad I saw it and listened to your counsel. But this buyer is still a jerk and I can't wait for this to be over so I can block him. I took your advice and sent the buyer a clarifying email. He verified and assured me he had received the incorrect item. After another exhaustive search, I found the item he ordered. I had shipped the item based on the brand, thinking I only had one item from that brand. Rather than inspecting it carefully against my photos, and I gotta tell you, I've done this more than once."
Yeah, Liz is not the first seller to have done this.
No, no, don't feel bad. This is why a lot of sellers then go on to develop as fail-safe a system as they can with identifying numbers and bin locations. Anyway, Liz says, "My hubby, who had assured me he did not recognize the item in the buyer's photos, recanted. The hubby recanted after she prevented this evidence. So feeling awful, I sent an apology with a mea culpa and an offer to send the correct item with free shipping and a generous discount." Now, that's a good seller.
It is.
However, the buyer then responded, asking me to send the correct item, and then he would compare the two and decide which, if any, he would like to keep, all at my expense, of course. I declined, thinking this is illegal per eBay guidelines, and requested he return the incorrect item for a full refund, including shipping both ways. To date, he still has not returned the incorrect item. He also challenged the authenticity of both items. Liz goes on. Ultimately, the incorrect item was $120. He only paid $100, so it's more valuable than the item he purchased. The item he purchased was listed for $100. The only other thing I could find for this item was $140. So already, pretty good deals. And I offered him additional 20%, so $80. He wanted both items with the second shipped outside of eBay protocol, and I was done at that point. I'm guessing I have no recourse, as this error was clearly my fault. I'm waiting to block him as a buyer until this is all resolved. Thoughts about that? I'm attending the eBay Open in Phoenix next month, and I hope to improve my skills with the overwhelming platform that is what eBay has become. Signed, Liz." This is a long one.
It is. I have an opinion on a couple things.
I made
some notes on a couple things.
Okay.
Or I jotted down some notes on my notepad next to me here.
What did you jot?
I jotted down block because I want to talk about that. And then I jotted down the buyer fraud kind of thing at the very beginning in the first part of the email.
So your thoughts?
So first off, I'll address her question whether or not she should send the second item. She should never send the second item.
Yeah.
Liz, if you haven't yet, do not ask eBay to step in.
Yeah, I wouldn't even ask eBay to step in at this point either.
And I'm pretty sure the buyer is not allowed to keep the first item and demand that you ship the second item.
No.
No seller is ever obliged to honor such a request.
Exactly. That would be a buyer trying to profit from the mistake of a seller. I'd simply ignore that request with a polite response saying that you'll refund him for the wrong item once you receive it and leave it at that. Remind the buyer how to open a return case, you know, be helpful. and which response to select, receive the wrong item. Also remind them that you will pay for return shipping, so they're not going to have to purchase that label.
So Liz, if you ask eBay to get involved, they will see the situation and tell the buyer to ship the item back to you.
Yeah, I'm certain of that, by the way.
Yeah.
eBay is not going to say, no, you have to ship the other item and then take your chances.
Agreed.
Always read through eBay help pages for topics like this one. If you search on eBay help for seller protections, you're going to find more information.
And another word about running a business.
Yes.
On eBay or anywhere else for that matter, you will run into difficult customers and you won't make a profit on every single sale.
True.
These are unavoidable facts of doing business. Don't focus on a single transaction. Look at your sales in aggregate over a period of a quarter, half year, or annually. That number is the only one that counts. Griff, what's your take on blocking buyers?
I think you know.
I think I do.
I've relaxed my take a little bit. So in the past, I was pretty strident in saying I would never block a buyer and I would never recommend that a seller block a buyer. I think it's okay. I mean, if you've had a really unpleasant experience, go ahead, put them on your block list. There's nothing wrong there. You can't, though, Liz, put this buyer on the block list while there's a transaction in process. I think you can, but it's not going to impact this particular transaction.
Correct.
Because it's already happened. But my advice about blocking buyers is if you're going to do it based on your own experience, do not hang out on the scrolling boards of doom looking for sellers complaining about buyers and then using their information to go and add that buyer to your block list.
Agreed.
There are two sides to every story, as Liz now sees. So I think the buyer is still making an unreasonable demand, but the initial mistake was a seller mistake, as unintentional and innocent as it was. Yeah, this is tricky. Because of what the buyer's demanding, I might think about blocking him. I think in this case, I would say, how do I turn this around? Making that request to send the item, if you look at it from the buyer's perspective, they may be thinking, what's up with you? Why did you send me the wrong item? And they just want to make sure they're covered. I would reassure them. I wouldn't block them in this case. I wouldn't block this buyer. I'd say, hey, my mistake. Send the item back.
And they'll get refunded.
They'll get refunded. And then I'll relist this item, buy it or bid on it, whatever the format is. And I'll make sure you get that one if you buy it or you're the winning bidder. I'm assuming it's buy it now.
Yeah.
And again, my return policy is pretty open. If you get it and you don't like it, you can ship it back. I'll pay for return shipping. My goal is to make you happy. I think that might be go a longer way to making a sale than saying, and now you're blocked. You've been declined.
Yeah, I would agree with you on this one, Griff. Like, I think what started off the situation was a seller mistake, and they happen. I mean, we're all human. Given that, the buyer's trying to protect themselves too, and I think I would just reassure that buyer that with money-back guarantee, eBay will refund them if they go through the process and return the item properly. You know, who knows? Maybe they're not even aware of that. I would be disinclined to block the buyer in this scenario since the beginning of this turned out to be not a great experience for either the buyer or the seller, started with the seller mistake.
Yeah, that's our advice. Well, I think you had a good take on it as well, Brian. So because this was a long one, that was the only questions we have this week.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought in an account-specific one. I mean, it's generic, but it's in a way that all of our sellers have these types of issues. Not exactly this scenario, but they run into return issues.
They do. I've had a few. I try to take my own advice because, as you know, sometimes I'm not in the best mood. And I did get a question about one of my items or two of my items this week, and both of them kind of started to set me off because both questions were, you could read maybe that the subtext was, are you a legitimate seller? And my first reaction, the visceral one, is to say, are you insinuating that I would sell inauthentic fragrances? Are you insinuating that the item that I said is brand new, for some reason, this feature doesn't work? But I pushed those feelings down, realized these could be buyers that have had a bad experience in the past. And I said, yeah, of course these are authentic. And yes, that feature does work. It's a brand new battery. It's a brand new item. It's never been worn. It's still in the box. Everything works. And I didn't block them because I want them to buy the items. I don't want to block them, right?
You know, sometimes I think when I see a seller on the boards who, you know, some of them are out there a lot, you kind of get a sense of their personalities. And there are a few that they'll complain maybe, you know, it's summertime, right? So we hear oftentimes, hey, my sales are down, it's summertime, or it's my sales are down, I think, I wonder how many buyers they have on their block bidder list. And the reality is that's not going to drive that metric.
No, I think if you've got 10, 20, even 50, it's not going to probably be. You know, where it gets me concerned is I've met sellers in the past that said, what's the limit for the number of people you can put on there? And I've said, I believe it's like 10,000 or something. He said, well, I'm getting there. And I'm thinking, you have almost 10,000 buyers on your block list? Boy.
That's a whole site.
That's paranoia. That's really bad.
And doing that many, it will likely have an impact. Because if you're a good seller and you have great inventory, you're going to want to have repeat buyers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's our questions for this week.
And if you have a question like Liz and Chris that you'd like us to try and answer, why not call it in on 888-723-4630.
Yeah, don't forget, we like email, but we love that call-in line. And no one's using it this summer. 888-723-4630. We feel ignored and abandoned. Call that hotline any time of the day and leave your question or comment, and we might put it on the air.
And if you're not a call-on-the-phone person, you can email us at podcast@ebay.com. That's podcast@ebay.com.
And now it's time for your three-point podcast checklist.
Check the announcement board at ebay.com/announcements for up-to-date seller news every day.
And though it's really hard sometimes to not do it, don't assume that the buyer is at fault. Gather all the information first and consider all possibilities, including an unintentional seller error. We all make them.
We all do. Need to review anything in this episode? It's easy. Check the transcript for this and all episodes for follow-up on what you've heard and to find the links we reference during the episode.
On our next episode, and you're going to love this because I know these two people are your favorite, we're going to talk to eBay seller Lori Bilou about the fulfillment service she and her husband David provide. It's called eBliss Fulfillment, and it's open to all eBay sellers. I think you're going to find this interesting.
And they are one of my favorites. I have lots of favorites.
Far be it from you to play favorites.
My children, I don't want, you know, one to think I like them more than the others. I'll get in trouble. We'd like to again thank our guest this week, eBay Seller Experience Chief of Staff, Valerie Yee.
We'll see you next week, Brian.
Yes.
The eBay for Business podcast is produced and distributed by Libsyn and Podcast 411.